Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was working in a coffee shop in Boston to like help pay rent while I was training for the trials. And so people kept joking. They're like, oh, yeah, she just took a 2-hour coffee break and went and ran the Olympic trials marathon.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their journeys to the top. On the Podium from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday, the 18th of August, these are our main stories. US officials investigate allegations of threats to intimidate people involved in former President Donald Trump's election interference case in Georgia. Dozens of migrants, mainly from Senegal, are feared to have died after their boat was found drifting near Cape Verde off the coast of West Africa. Britain invites the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to visit, outraging human rights groups. Also in this podcast... The musician Nile Rodgers accuses a far-right political party in Switzerland of stealing his hit song, We Are Family. Officials in the US state of Georgia are investigating online threats against members of the public who voted to indict the former US President Donald Trump this week as part of a grand jury. Amid a rise in violent rhetoric by Trump supporters, the Georgia grand jurors aren't the only ones to be targeted. A woman in Texas has been charged for threatening to kill a judge overseeing another case against Mr. Trump. And last week, FBI agents killed a man in Utah who'd reportedly made death threats against President Joe Biden. I got more from our U.S. correspondent, Anthony Zerker.
Georgia law enforcement is investigating threats made against members of the grand jury that indicted Donald Trump on Monday. These threats have been posted in right-wing message boards and chat rooms online, and information about the jurors has been shared on these right-wing outlets. Have to remember that the identity of the jurors were made public in the indictment. That's something that Georgia does routinely. In any indictment, they list the grand jurors who brought the indictment in the trove of documents that are publicly released. So the names of all these jurors were made public. What has happened is that Donald Trump supporters have taken these names and done research and posted photographs and posted addresses and looked into their social media history and apparently, according to law enforcement, made threats against them. And that is what law enforcement is looking into, because this could be an example of juror intimidation, something that would disrupt the proper functioning of the legal system in the United States.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because what does this mean for the security of this legal process? I mean, how do you protect people like jurors and judges when they're being threatened?
That is a very real challenge. In a state like Georgia that does something like this whole process very openly, very transparently, and then the goal is doing it in public and doing it transparent in order to allow the public to have greater faith in the legal system. The downside of that is that bad actors could access the information on these people and bring threats. And while law enforcement can look into it and prosecute if need be, that happens after the fact. And there is definitely a chilling effect for future jurors, for future people who might want to take part in the justice system, the justice process, when they get a juror summons, to think twice about doing so if they read about how past jurors have been targeted by individuals. There was actually a woman who was recently arrested and charges brought against her in Texas for phoning in a death threat against the federal judge who is presiding over Donald Trump's federal trial in Washington, D.C. on charges of 2020 election interference. So this is not just something theoretical. This is something that is happening right now. And unfortunately, it is something that is very difficult to nip in the bud, and control ahead of time.
Anthony Zerker. More than 60 migrants are presumed dead after their boat was found drifting near Cape Verde off the coast of West Africa. 38 people, including several children, were brought to shore. It's thought they set off from Senegal more than a month ago, headed for the Canary Islands. Mayeni Jones reports.
This latest incident highlights why the journey from the western coast of Africa to the Canary Islands is described as one of the most dangerous migrant crossings in the world. After 5 weeks at sea, the wooden boat carrying 38 survivors was spotted drifting in West African waters. It's unclear what happened to the 60 other passengers that are missing, but they're presumed dead. Most of them came from the small Senegalese fishing village of Fassboy. Mamou Ba's 23-year-old brother Shekuna died during the journey. He said they'd both tried getting to Europe by boat just a few weeks earlier.
My brother who died, we got on a boat to Spain together the day after Eid, on 30th June. So this latest trip was Shekuna's second attempt at getting to Europe by boat. 3 days after we came back, he set off again. He was determined to leave because he had a family and there was nothing for us here in Senegal. We are fishermen. We work all day and we make no money. He just wanted to feed his family.
A booming population, crumbling economies and growing insecurity are pushing young people to leave West Africa in their thousands. As legal pathways into Europe tighten, many of them are turning to dangerous illegal routes in search of a better life.
Mayeni Jones. As we heard in our earlier edition, West African military chiefs say they're prepared to use force to restore democracy in Niger following last month's coup. They've been meeting in the Ghanaian capital Accra to discuss the deployment of a standby force for possible military intervention to restore democracy in Niger. Three members of the bloc, Mali, Burkina Faso and Guinea, currently under military rule themselves, support the junta in Niger and oppose any outside military intervention. My colleague James Reynolds spoke to the BBC's Thomas Nardi in Accra, in Ghana, who's been covering the meeting of ECOWAS military chiefs, and was also joined by the BBC's West Africa reporter Nkechi Ogbonna in Lagos, Nigeria. So, will the regional bloc's military chiefs recommend sending in troops to Niger?
ECOWAS is already getting ready to move into Niger, and what the military chiefs are doing here today is just to firm up the decisions that they've taken and tie the loose ends so that if the order is given for them to move in, they'll be able to quickly do that. Now, it's just part of efforts to ramp up pressure on the junta to force him to come to the negotiating table. And that's because in the past, he's not yielded to the demand of ECOWAS or rejected both international and then efforts by religious leaders to mediate in the crisis. So ECOWAS is just trying to ensure that all the time there's constant reminder and pressure on the junta to return the country to constitutional rule.
Nkechi Ogbonna, you're in Lagos, and of course Nigeria borders Niger. Thinking about a potential deployment, what would that look like? Where would troops be recruited from?
So the thing is, previous missions like this have shown how troops are drawn from each member state under the umbrella ECOMOG, meaning ECOWAS Monitoring Group. We have seen that play out in Liberia and the Gambia in a couple of years ago. And so it's expected that that would be the same formula that would be used for the deployment of troops and the formation of the squad that would be heading into Niger. Although at this time, Ivory Coast is the only country that has declared it would deploy about 1,000 troops for the intervention plan should they decide to use a military route. However, Senegal and Benin Republic have also said they will also send an unspecified number of troops. But other countries like Nigeria and Togo and the likes are yet to say what exactly their deployment plans would be. But it's expected that bordering states would have troops heading towards the states that border Nigeria and Niger for ground forces who are probably going to make any intervention.
Now, of course, we talked about diplomacy and Nkechi talking there about logistics. Let's talk about public opinion, though, in the countries in which you both are. How do ordinary people feel about what's going on in Niger, Thomas, and also a potential deployment? Because I know you've been speaking to some people.
Yeah, I think public opinion is very divided. And in some of the countries that are going to take part in this particular intervention, in Ghana, for instance, the opposition is strongly against it. And I spoke to some few people on the streets of Antwerp. This is what they had to say.
It's good in Ghana to send the armies there to restore the democracy. I don't support the idea because it's rather going to bring challenges to us because we already have our problems. So let's rather concentrate on ourselves than going to fight someone's war. My idea is that going to war and spending money is rather going to bring economic challenges. So let us rather concentrate on ourselves and then mind our own business than going to fight someone's war.
They shouldn't. I think it's about time they all come together and settle the issue once and for all. It is not about war. You know, it's about peace. That's what we want in Africa. So I don't agree that they should go and fight and invade Niger. No.
If it helps out, if it will be a greater good, why not? I don't see it to be a problem.
Interesting to hear, Thomas, some of those conflicting views there, including the person who said we should mind our own business. Moving across Nkechi to where you are in Nigeria, what sense do you get about public opinion?
Very similar to what's happening in Ghana. Nigerians are very divided on the issues that concern Niger. First off, part of the, especially the online community, believe that Nigeria has enough problems. We have soaring inflation. We have an economic crisis. We have rising food prices and commodity prices. Everything is going skyrocketing. Inflation is over 24%. And people believe, look, we have bigger problems to deal with than Niger. Unfortunately, what has happened to Niger has happened. However, let Nigerians solve their problems.
And Nkechi Ogbonna and Thomas Nnadi talking about the crisis in Niger. Saudi officials have confirmed to the BBC that the British government has invited Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to visit the UK. It's understood that dates in October are being considered. Downing Street says Rishi Sunak spoke on the phone to the Saudi leader, telling him he looked forward to meeting at the, quote, earliest opportunity. But the visit has been criticised by opposition parties and human rights groups who say the UK should not be welcoming a man with such a poor human rights record. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, reports.
This, if it goes ahead, will be a highly controversial visit. The Saudi Crown Prince, still only in his late 30s, is credited with transforming Saudi society for the better. He scrapped the ban on women driving and he's brought back public entertainment, long banned by the religious clerics. He's also investing Saudi Arabia's massive oil wealth in diversifying the economy away from petrochemicals. It's some of this trillion-dollar-plus fortune that 10 Downing Street would like to see come to Britain. But the Crown Prince, who effectively rules his country unchallenged, has been something of a pariah in many Western capitals for the past 5 years. He's widely suspected of ordering the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi journalist critical of his policies, inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The prince denies any involvement, but human rights activists, including the chief executive of Amnesty International, Sasha Deshmukh, firmly believe he should not be invited to Britain.
I would be very worried by an invitation for a visit where it appears that the UK government is sending a clear message that UK leadership on human rights, which is something that we should be proud of, is now taking a back seat.
A statement released by Number 10 today talked in glowing terms about Anglo-Saudi cooperation in defence, security and cutting-edge technology, yet made no mention of human rights. But Labour's deputy leader, Angela Rayner, said it was essential these were discussed during the Crown Prince's visit and that dialogue between the two nations continued.
Frank Gardner. Last year, the UN's annual climate conference was held in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The exquisite, multicoloured coral reefs and dazzlingly beautiful marine life in the crystal-clear waters of the sea, a perfect reminder of what's at stake if world leaders fail to protect the environment. Now, Israel's Environment Ministry has said that the Red Sea is warming more than twice as fast as the global average, posing a threat to this underwater paradise. Our Middle East analyst Mike Thompson told me more.
1,200 species of fish down there in the Red Sea, and that includes 44 different species of sharks and 200 different types of coral. And this is partly because the waters are very clear compared to many oceans, and the sunlight's able to penetrate, and that gives an abundance of splendid sea life.
But now there's this warning that all this splendid sea life is under threat. Why do scientists think that this particular sea is warming so fast?
Well, one of the reasons is that it's enclosed by some very hot areas of land right around it in the Gulf. But even more importantly, it's quite shallow. And that means it can heat up much more than, say, the Caribbean, which is very hot, but the ocean's about 10 times deeper. So that's fundamentally it. And of course, there is, like elsewhere, sadly, pollution is a factor.
So how much of a threat is all this, given that the coral in the Red Sea has, up until now, held up pretty well to climate change compared to coral elsewhere?
It has, yes. I mean, one of the factors here, it seems that scientists believe that the algae that's there has actually come from the Indian Ocean thousands of years ago. So it had to pass through some very hot seas. So only the most resilient managed to then survive when they were in the north of the Red Sea. And so for that reason, it's been able to survive better than others. But growing temperatures, rising pollution is a big problem. And also we've seen the sea turtle population has been declining. And the sea turtles, they help to balance the coral and algae within the ecosystem. And that's really quite vital. They've been suffering from a disease. And all of these factors combined mean, despite the resilience of this algae, we could see a lot of it going. And already around 20% in some areas has been badly damaged.
Mike Thompson. Still to come, the Ukrainian university students about to embark on their studies who potentially risk being called up to the military.
I don't want to go anywhere. Kyiv is my home. Here is everything I made in 17 years I lived. Like all my friends, my family, everything.
What in the World is the podcast exploring the stories and the issues that you need to know about.
93% of fast fashion workers aren't getting paid a living wage.
The former president is accused of trying to overturn democracy.
How do elite athletes train in and around their menstrual cycle?
Understand more, feel better with What in the World from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Opposition leaders in Serbia are taking legal action against one of the country's most popular broadcasters. They say Pink TV is using artificial intelligence to alter video clips of their television appearances. Here's our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaney.
Pink TV is well known for its pro-government stance, so it's no stranger to the mockery of opposition figures. But now it's deploying artificial intelligence to create video clips in which the opposition leaders mock themselves. A casual viewer would find it hard to tell that the soundtrack to the original clips has been replaced, and the opposition say that's unacceptable. The leader of the Party of Freedom and Justice, Dragan Gilas, is starting legal action against Pink TV. He warns that AI manipulation could have catastrophic consequences. Pink's management insists that the clips are satirical and a humorous depiction of Serbian reality.
Guy Delaney. At this time of year, millions of young people around the world are preparing to start university. It can be a challenging time. But in Ukraine, students there are having to grapple with problems that could potentially decide whether they live or die. From Kyiv, Toby Luckhurst reports.
It's been a tough and unusual few years to be a university student here in Ukraine.
There are some students that never attended university offline because they were accepted when the COVID was and some scale invasions, so they never really was in a class offline. Yes, it's a little bit sad.
I meet this group of undergraduates outside Kyiv Mohyla Academy, a university here in the Ukrainian capital. They're standing outside the admissions office, helping people who are applying for a spot before term starts in September. This is a welcome video for new students. There's no mention of war. It's like a standard welcome video at any other university in the world. The Kyiv Mohyla president is telling students about the community and all the opportunities students can have here. But like all things now in Ukraine, the war has raised unique challenges for the country's university students. Nastya is a student originally from Lviv.
The parents of male students, they're mostly willing their children to stay abroad so as not to be mobilized because they're like upcoming to be 18 and they could be recruited to army.
Under current laws brought in after Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, men aged between 18 and 60 can't cross the country's borders without special permission from the government. That means male students who decide to study at home in Ukraine can't go abroad. And those who go study abroad won't be able to come back home to visit without risking getting stuck inside the country.
I just got accepted to Kyivo-Mohylyanska Academia. I live in Kyiv, and I'm not planning to go anywhere. I haven't left country since the war started, and I don't want to.
Misha is a 17-year-old from Kyiv who's starting at Kyiv-Mohyla in September. He thought about studying abroad and escaping Ukraine completely, but the risk of getting trapped on the other side of the border and unable to see his family made him think twice.
I don't want to go anywhere. Kyiv is my home. Here is everything I made in 17 years I lived. All my friends, my family, everything.
Today, Ukraine students are protected from the military draft. That means while they're studying, men here won't be called up to fight. But that could change. And deciding to study at home means taking that risk.
My parents were pressuring me so hard to go somewhere because I might get drafted to army, I might get killed by rocket.
He turns 18 next year, but doesn't plan to leave before then. And he's optimistic about Ukraine's future and keen to help get the country back on its feet. Russia is showing no sign of halting its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And with term due to start here at Kyiv-Mohyla in just a couple of weeks' time, students enrolling here today have no clue what could happen during their degrees and what kind of country they'll be graduating into in just a few years' time.
That report by Toby Luckhurst in Kyiv. It's more than 100 days since US film and television writers went on strike, and there are signs that a deal may be close. Their union is currently considering a new offer from the major studios. The screenwriters were joined by members of the American Actors Guild SAG-AFTRA last month. The action has resulted in a serious halting of major Hollywood productions. David Weddle is a TV writer and producer who's worked on a wide range of series, including Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, Battlestar Galactica, and CSI Crime Scene Investigation. He's now also a strike coordinator for union members at Sony Studios. Simon Jack asked him why he felt optimistic that studio executives were finally willing to cut a deal now.
My sense of it is they are circling. They would like to make a deal. They want to see if they can beat us down a little bit first. That gets to give some ground. But ultimately, I think, you know, my sense is in the next month to 2 months, there will be a deal in place.
What are the key demands that the writers have here? What do they need to secure?
As writers, we give up our copyright to our material in exchange for residuals, which is a profit-sharing agreement with the studios that we, who create the original product that they then market all over the world, that we share in the revenue from that because we created it. Since the streaming era, they have managed to crank down the faucet till it's only a dribble. And we writers depend on those residuals when we're in between shows. Because we are itinerant workers that move from job to job, like people that work the harvests. They have refused to pay us our fair share, decent residuals for streaming, refused to even show us the number of views that they are getting for their streaming material. And that's put our income at jeopardy. All of us are stressed trying to make ends meet. It's not fair.
It's been widely reported there's a sort of AI, artificial intelligence element in this. What's the fear there and what kind of reassurances are you looking for?
They're not going to have a robot write TV. They know even the people in charge of these conglomerates that don't understand TV business know that much. But they think, why not bring in a robot to take all the notes, to write even like assemble plots, develop outlines that then the showrunners and the number two can rewrite? Well, that eliminates, again, younger writers. And then how are you going to have showrunners and number two, the twos that even understand the business if they never had that training, if a robot did it?
How important has the support of actors been?
Hugely important. It was a checkmate. It was a Waterloo moment. They had a grand strategy and it blew up in their faces. And it's been extremely important. Because now all production is shut down throughout the American entertainment business. And they are facing a complete shutoff of new product. Mm-hmm. And now they're in trouble. And now they finally realized it. So the actors gave us the clout to go back to them and get a strong contract, which in turn will then help the actors.
Content is everything, isn't it? You know, once you start emptying the bucket of what's available on the various streaming platforms, that is terrifying to the streamers themselves because they know that without new content, people will go elsewhere.
It's beginning to dawn on them, yes. I mean, I know many people, friends who are not in the business, who tell me they're canceling apps right and left, not only because these conglomerates are charging more, but because there's nothing new. There's nothing new they want to watch. And just as in 2007, the studios pretended they were unconcerned. Oh, we'll just do reality television. It's cheaper anyway. And people love reality television. They don't care about drama, which is too expensive. They talk themselves into this. And every 15 years, we have to re-educate a new generation of studio executives who think that they don't need us. And then they have to find out that they do. And then they lose their appetite for this kind of strike to happen, at least for another 15 years.
TV writer David Weddle. During election campaigns, politicians often draw on popular music as a way of getting their message across and to engage potential voters. But it can cause problems when musicians object to their songs being used to promote political views they strongly disagree with. Nile Rodgers is the latest musician to make such a complaint about his hit song, We Are Family. The American had told a far-right political party in Switzerland to stop using a track which has a very similar chorus to the 70s disco classic. Chantal Hartl reports.
Recorded by Sister Sledge in 1979, We Are Family went on to become a huge hit around the world. The song celebrates the sisters' family bond and is used in popular culture more generally to express solidarity. So when Nile Rodgers heard this, he made it clear he wasn't happy with the Swiss People's Party, or the SVP as it's known, and its election campaign video, which shows party members wearing brightly coloured sunglasses, dancing and waving glow sticks in a nightclub. The SVP is the biggest party in Switzerland's coalition government and is known for its anti-immigration policies and Eurosceptic views. In a statement, Rodgers said his song was intended to be about diversity and inclusion and that he condemned its use by the Swiss party or anyone who didn't share those values. SVP politician Thomas Matter, who's credited as the songwriter under the name DJ Tommy, said the anthem was an original composition. But Swiss media have reported that for years, Mr. Matter's mobile phone ringtone has been We Are Family. This issue has repeatedly come up in the US during Donald Trump's election rallies. The former president has angered a long list of musicians, including Elton John, the Rolling Stones, and Creedence Clearwater Revival, who've all opposed the use of their music for political reasons. Some have threatened legal action. And in 2017, the American rapper Eminem won a $600,000 copyright lawsuit after the New Zealand National Party used his song. A court ruled that the National Party's election advert was sufficiently similar to Eminem's track.
That report by Chantal Hartl. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley. It was mixed by Chris Hansen. And the editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.